Hello and welcome to Science World. NASA's Dawn spacecraft was captured by the gravitational pull of the dwarf planet Ceres at 12:39 UTC Friday, March 6th. George Putich tells us about what NASA is expecting from the mission. Forecasting the weather, it said, is more an art than science. Reporting from Colorado, Shelley Schlender will tell us about an observation system that is working to improve weather science through volunteers who share their data through the Internet. And an international group of astronomers found that a dim star known as a red dwarf skimmed through the outskirts of our solar system some 70,000 years ago. A member of this group is Dr. Eric Mamajek from the University of Rochester. He talks about this amazing discovery on today's one-on-one segment. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA Science, Health and Technology Magazine, Science World. At 12:39 UTC Friday, March 6th, NASA's Dawn spacecraft was captured by the gravitational pull of the dwarf planet Ceres. Along with previously planned objectives, Dawn will also try to examine two mysterious bright white spots that had been detected on the planet's surface. George Putich has more.
At its closest approach to Ceres, Dawn will be about 10 times closer to the mini-planet than the Moon is to the Earth. Scientists believe asteroids like Ceres may have been the source of water on Earth. But they are especially intrigued by two bright spots in a 92-kilometer-wide crater that might be related to previously detected vapor emissions. At a NASA press conference, Deputy Principal Investigator Carol Raymond says Ceres is unique in the solar system.
We will be revealing its true nature as we get closer and closer to the surface. So the mystery will be solved, but it is one that's really got us on the edge of our seats.
Director of NASA's Planetary Science Division, Jim Green, said Dawn is a unique spacecraft.
It has ion engines, and it's the only one that we've ever launched to be able to orbit two bodies, and in this case, Vesta and Ceres.
Ion engines create thrust by releasing charged particles of xenon gas, giving a characteristic bluish glow while slowly accelerating the spacecraft. In 7.5 years, Dawn reached a speed of more than 38,000 kilometers per hour. The spacecraft has extra-long solar panels to power it on its journey to Ceres, which is 3 times farther from the Sun than Earth. On its way to its final destination, Dawn also visited Vesta, another protoplanet in the asteroid belt that has evolved very little from the time it was created. Scientists hope that analysis of the collected data will help them better understand the birth of our solar system. After about a month of adjusting its orbit, Dawn will start sending back data in what are expected to be stunning pictures of this strange remote celestial object. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Forecasting the weather, it said, is more an art than a science. A weather observation system called COCOROS is working to improve weather science through volunteers who measure precipitation in their own backyards and then share their data through the Internet. Shelley Schlender reports from Colorado.
Even when it's sunny in Lyons, Colorado, Bunny Pham checks a special plastic cylinder she's mounted on her fence. Her rain gauge.
I think there's something kind of exciting about collecting information that would, you know, if you collect it for enough years, it represents climate data.
2 years ago, during a week of historic rainfall, local rivers overflowed. Nearby buildings were swept away. Pham stayed home and checked her rain gauge.
The night when the flooding began, there was about 3.75 inches of rain that fell here in my yard that day, which is the largest amount of rain by far that I've ever recorded in a 24-hour period.
This morning, as Pham walks across her yard, she leaves footprints and a light dusting of snow.
See, so it is snowing.
She checks her rain gauge, and sure enough, there is a little snow in it.
I have to melt this down and see the water content.
Pham carries the gauge to her kitchen, where she melts the snow and measures the resulting water.
I always try to make sure every drop comes out to be more accurate. So it's 4/100ths out of that 3/10 of an inch of snow, which is pretty wet. but it's just a little bit of snow.
Then she sits down at her computer to share her data online with weather scientists.
They mostly want me to enter two things, so the water content of the snow, which was 4/100, and the new snowfall, which was 3/10.
On the web, Fau's data shows up as a dot on a map of Lyons, Colorado. Her dot is color-coded light blue to show it's a low amount of precipitation. The map shows dozens of other dots nearby, and many are a darker blue, indicating more moisture. They join thousands of other dots on a national map, ranging from gray for no rain to red for a downpour. All these dots are posted by backyard weather watchers. Also online are training videos, and they even explain the name of this project, which is COCORAS.
COCORAS, the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network, is made up of thousands of people, just like you, mapping and measuring rain and snow as it falls from the sky.
COCORAS supporters include meteorologist Matt Kelsch, who coordinates a two-county region of 200 volunteers.
The value of COCORAS is that citizens can get a tremendous amount of information about rain and snow that falls or rain and snow that doesn't fall. And certainly it benefits the meteorological community, like the community I'm in, but it also greatly benefits hydrologists, water resource managers, even people that aren't trained as scientists that are dealing with water resources.
There are four official National Weather Service sites in his two-county region, Kelsch says, but they're too far apart to account for what can be highly variable local conditions. Fortunately, his volunteers send in a wealth of data from many different sites.
On a typical rainy or snowy day, we could get 100 reports from COCORAS in the two-county area.
Radar and satellite data can predict regional weather, but they don't provide accurate on-the-ground detail, according to COCORAS founder, Colorado State climatologist Nolan Deskin. He says the science is improving, thanks in part to COCORAS.
By giving that ground validation, we can then improve the relationships between what we're seeing from space or from a remote transmitter and relating it to what's happening at our point in our town, our city, our county, our state.
With more than 20,000 active volunteers, COCORAS is the largest provider of daily precipitation observations in the U.S. Still, Deskin says there's room for more.
We see that rainfall varies on a mile-to-mile, actually a block-to-block basis, and if we had one citizen to do a measurement in every square mile of the entire country, it wouldn't be too many.
COCORAS also has volunteers in most of the Canadian provinces, Puerto Rico, and soon the U.S. Virgin Islands. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Lyons, Colorado.
It's time for the Science World Quick Quiz. After a 7.5-year journey, NASA's Dawn spacecraft is now orbiting the dwarf planet Ceres. The space probe made its 1.5 billion kilometer trip to Ceres with a sophisticated propulsion system. From the following, what is this unique propulsion method called? A. Chemical propulsion system. B. Ion propulsion system. Or C. Pulsed plasma propulsion system. Think about it. We'll have the correct answer in a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the Internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Scientists in the Philippines are at work on a strain of rice that could solve one of the world's major health challenges, vitamin A deficiency. From Manila, Simone Orendine checks in on the fierce debate over the rice with the distinctive yellow color.
To supporters of golden rice, the crop offers enormous potential for eliminating as many as 2 million deaths each year from vitamin A deficiency, which mainly impacts young children and pregnant women. The beta-carotene in the new rice is a precursor for vitamin A, which is missing in the diets of millions of people in the developing world. Vitamin A deficiency is the leading cause of childhood blindness and is a public health problem in half of all countries, many in Africa and Southeast Asia. For Canadian ecologist Patrick Moore, there should be no debate over whether farmers should grow golden rice.
Why is there not the same revulsion at 2 million children dying to let golden rice out so at least some people can get it, and maybe more and more and more?
But critics of golden rice, including the Greenpeace environmental group, have long opposed the crop because of the genetic engineering involved in its creation. Moore was an early member of Greenpeace in the 1970s and early 80s, but has since become a critic of the group's stance on a range of issues, including golden rice. In response to queries about Moore's criticism, Greenpeace emailed a statement that said genetically engineered crops consist almost entirely of herbicide-tolerant and insect-resistant crops marketed to developing countries, and that this model is detrimental to people's health, farmers' livelihoods, and the environment. Unlike some genetically modified crops designed by corporations that patent the plants, the golden rice being developed in the Philippines is financed by public funds. A range of philanthropic and public sector groups have worked to engineer the crop and improve its production. They hope that farmers in the developing world will eventually grow it, addressing a major public health issue that many scientists say is on the scale of malaria or tuberculosis. But Manila-based Greenpeace Southeast Asia agriculture campaigner Daniel Ocampo says after 20 years of research, golden rice is not ready for consumption and could be more dangerous than its supporters will admit.
It's still in the laboratory. It's not available commercially. So it's really misleading the public when they say that it's going to be one of the solutions to vitamin A deficiency.
Greenpeace is instead pushing what it calls ecological agriculture, which it says is climate resilient and will let people access food that meets their nutritional needs. A year and a half ago, a group of anti-GMO activists overran one of the golden rice test plots in the Philippines' Bicol region and destroyed it in a protest against the project. The incident raised the profile of the conflict over golden rice and led some to accuse Greenpeace of being behind the protests and the destruction, but the organization says it had nothing to do with it. The International Rice Research Institute, just south of Manila, has been doing breeding experiments with golden rice for 9 years, but says they must still conduct more research before it is ready for human consumption. Simone Orendain for VOA News, Manila.
China has pledged to get tough on polluters and tighten enforcement in a bid to clean up its environment, an issue that is one of the Chinese public's biggest concerns. Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
China has seen massive economic growth over the past 3 decades, but that has come at a huge cost to its environment in the form of soil, water, and air pollution. As its economy continues to slow and the government has targeted a rate of growth that is the country's slowest in a quarter of a century, it is looking more towards sustained quality growth. Cleaning up the environment is a key part of that equation. Last year, China declared war on air pollution, and in his annual work report to China's National People's Congress Thursday, Premier Li Keqiang pledged to continue to do more. Li says that environmental pollution is a blight on the people's quality of life and a trouble that weighs heavy on their hearts. He says the country's leaders must fight it with all our might. One of the key areas China needs to take that fight is its struggle to reduce its dependence on coal, which it has relied on for cheap energy. But that has made China the world's biggest producer and consumer of coal, which is a main source of air pollution. Premier Li says China will upgrade emission controls at coal-burning power plants and strive for zero growth in the consumption of coal this year in key areas of the country. In a report on economic development that was released Thursday, China's National Development and Reform Commission also took aim at polluting fossil fuels. The report said in areas affected by severe smog, the government would strictly control the number of energy-intensive industries and consider replacing coal plants with alternative energy sources. Last year was the first time this century that China saw its consumption of coal drop. In his speech, Li also pledged to get tough on polluters. He says the government must strictly enforce environmental laws and regulations, crack down on those guilty of creating illegal discharges and emissions, and ensure they pay a heavy price for such offenses. China has been talking about getting tough on the environment for years, and it is hard to say just yet how far authorities will go. Last year, only 8 of 74 Chinese cities met their air quality targets. City University of Hong Kong professor Chan King Ming says it is a good sign that officials are highlighting the issue's importance, but enforcing environmental laws have always been the biggest challenge. The reason for that, he adds, is that there are so many layers of officials to work through, from the central government on down to those at the city and county level.
I still have much reservation that the Chinese officials at these different levels could cooperate with the Beijing government.
Chan says that it will also be difficult to impose controls that could impact the energy available for fast-growing cities and counties, where there is a hunger for development and growth. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. After a 7.5-year journey, NASA's Dawn spacecraft is now orbiting the dwarf planet Ceres. The space probe made its 1.5 billion kilometer trip to Ceres with a sophisticated propulsion system. From the following, what is this unique propulsion method called? A. Chemical propulsion system. B. Ion propulsion system. Or C. Pulsed plasma propulsion system. The answer is B. The ion propulsion system. According to NASA, the ion propulsion system aboard Dawn uses an electrical charge to accelerate ions from xenon fuel that allows the spacecraft to travel at speeds of 10 times that of traditional chemical engines. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
A group of astronomers from the U.S., Europe, Chile, and South Africa recently found that a dim star known as a red dwarf skimmed through the outskirts of our solar system, coming within 8 trillion kilometers of Earth some 70,000 years ago. It's the closest known flyby of a star to our solar system. In geological terms, 70,000 years is a mere blip on our planet's timeline. By the way, modern man was roaming the Earth at that time. The star, known as Schulze Star, was discovered in 2013, and since then, astronomers have noticed that it's moving away from our solar system at a significant rate of speed. Its current location, about 20 light years away, along with its current rapid acceleration from Earth, got the astronomical team thinking about the trajectory the star may have taken over the years. Feeding data from previous observations into a computer model, it was determined that Schulze's star had traveled through the outer Oort cloud located on the edge of the solar system a mere 70,000 years ago. Dr. Eric Mamajek from the University of Rochester was among the scientists who made this discovery after analyzing the velocity and trajectory of Schulze's star. Dr. Mamajek joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about this amazingly close call with another star system, as well as the research he and his colleagues conducted to make this discovery.
So the star was just discovered in the end of 2013 by the German astronomer Ralph Dieter Schultz. Its designation is WISE-J072003.20-08-4651. So we're not calling it by that anymore because it's just too lengthy. So we've nicknamed it Schulze's star. It was only discovered very recently. And the reason it was only discovered very recently is it's very faint and it was in the galactic plane. And there's lots and lots of stars, lots of faint stars in the galactic plane. And this one actually had a pretty small proper motion. Its motion across the sky was very slow. And all those factors contributed to it not being discovered until very recently. And so once it was, it came out, my colleagues, Valentin Ivanov at European Southern Observatory and a few of his collaborators started characterizing this star. they were doing some follow-up study to learn more about it. It was such a nearby system, and it was very, very low mass. It was scientifically interesting. So I heard about the project, and I said, I wonder why this star was only discovered so recently. And I looked at the proper motion of it, and I realized it was so slow that given how near the star was, it was probably either coming towards us or away from us. And this group had measured the first radial velocity for it, and indeed it was running away from us at high speed. You can measure the Doppler shift of the stars. So it's running away from us at about 80 kilometers per second, and it's traveled about 20 light years in 70,000 years. But I have a galactic dynamics code, and I plugged in the numbers, I plugged in the position and the motion of the star, and ran it back in time, and lo and behold, there it was 70,000 years ago, just within a light year of the sun. We knew right away that this was the closest flyby that had ever been detected of a star. We needed to do some calculations to figure out how important it was dynamically.
70,000 years ago is pretty close to being a blink of the eye in geological terms. And although the star passed through the basic outer limits of our solar system through the Oort cloud, are there any signs that it did have any kind of impact as it passed through?
So far, no. It came within 0.8 light years, about 50,000 astronomical units. We do know there's the Oort cloud. There's a cloud of something like a trillion comets on the outskirts of the solar system, and that goes out on the order of a few light years. The sun sort of dominates this local region of space due to its gravity. We know these comets are there because we see these long-period comets coming into the inner solar system. There needs to be a vast reservoir of these bodies. So there's certainly objects out there. They're few and far between. It's mostly empty space out there. So almost certainly there were objects that were perturbed in the Oort cloud by this star. But fortunately, the region it passed was pretty far out. At about 50,000 light years, the Oort cloud is pretty thin. Where you would start to be concerned is if the star came within 20,000 AU or 10,000 AU of the sun. The inner Oort cloud, and there's many more objects there. And right now it looks like we're very confident that it did not come through the inner Oort cloud. We think it went through the lower density outer Oort cloud. It will have kicked up some comets, and some of those comets will come into the inner solar system, but we get comets from the Oort cloud passing through every year. Many of the comets that come through are very long period comets. They spend many, many thousands of years out in the Oort cloud. And some of the ones we see today even may have been kicked in by the previous passages of stars. The good thing about Schultz's star is it had a good combination of mass and velocity. It's very low mass and it's very high velocity. Okay, it was like a little hummingbird whizzing through within arm's length. It really didn't have a huge effect on the Oort cloud. The worst case scenario would be an object that came very close but was much more massive and slower, and that could wreak havoc in the Oort cloud. Fortunately, such stars are very rare and few and far between. So Schultz's star looked like it probably had negligible impact on the Oort cloud. I wouldn't lose any sleep over it.
Where is it located now?
The star's in the constellation Monoceros. So if you look between, in the winter skies, if you look between Orion and Sirius and Procyon, those two bright stars in the constellation Orion, there's a really faint constellation called Monoceros. And in that constellation, there's a very, 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 very dim star. We use magnitudes. It's 18th magnitude. So it's many, many thousands of times fainter than you can see with the naked eye. And that is Schultz's star. It's moving about 80 kilometers a second, which is fast as stars go. It's faster than the typical star. And at 1 kilometer per second, you can traverse a lot of space. You can cover about 3 light years in a million years. And so this object's moving about 80 kilometers a second. It's covered about 20 light years in the last 70,000 years. The stars that we see today in the solar neighborhood, you know, if you come back 100,000 years from now or a million years from now, the stars are moving constantly. All the stars are moving with respect to each other. They're all on their own different shaped orbits around the galaxy. So the stars that look like our neighbors now, if you come back in a few million years, we'll be in the vicinity of a completely different set of stars.
That was Dr. Eric Mamajek from the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Bantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.